A theme of the book of 1 Peter is the suffering Christian. We live in a blessed age in this country, this part of the world, in that there's almost no persecution, and that we have free access to the Bible, that we have freedom of assembly, and that we can worship God as He has directed in the New Testament. There's so many blessings that we enjoy that are so different and were so lacking in parts of the world, and especially in the first century when the world was dominated by the Roman Empire and so many forces that were contrary to the way of Christ. In 1 Peter chapter 4 and verse 19, Peter wrote, "Wherefore let them that suffer according to the will of God commit the keeping of their souls to Him in well-doing as unto a faithful Creator." Here he's talking about those who suffer according to the will of God. That is, sometimes when persecution comes, in fact, always, it's according to the will of God. That is, God permits it. God doesn't send it. He doesn't wish it, but He may permit it because of His great plan, His providential care of all His people. And this is something that every Christian needs to realize, is that we must commit our souls to His keeping, even in the midst of trials. Peter had stressed the importance of the soul, and we realize that our soul is our eternal part, that within our physical and temporal bodies is an eternal spirit that cannot die. But it has a need, and that need is to be saved. In 1 Peter chapter 1 and verse 9, receiving the end of your faith, even the salvation of your souls. You see, the soul needs to be saved, and saved from the penalty of sin. Sin is what happens in our mortal bodies, and it's a choice that we make. But God will hold our souls accountable. We realize that in the great day of judgment, Jesus will have raised all the dead. Soul and body will be reunited, and all will stand there before the judgment seat of Christ to answer according to how they've lived in the body. There's a great need of salvation. And this is one of the reasons, of course, that Peter is writing to his recipients to help them to realize that despite the suffering that you may be enduring and the persecution that's going on, remember it's the salvation of your soul that is the ultimate need. Because on the other hand, our bodies seem to war against that purpose. Within our bodies are various desires. God has created us that way. These things are necessary for our, you might say, living in the world, that we have certain desires and needs and wants. Otherwise, I suppose we would just sit idly somewhere on a stone and waste away. But God has given us desires, and those desires, when used in the proper attitude, are for the furtherance of the race, for the development of ourselves as people, for fulfilling the various needs that we have. But on the other hand, there are those fleshly things that sometimes can war against us. In fact, Peter says in 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 11, "Dearly beloved, I beseech you as strangers and pilgrims, abstain from fleshly lusts which war against the soul." There are certain things that, as it were, work against our eternal salvation if we allow them to dominate in our lives. Now, we may not be able to throw them out because they're a part of our being, but they don't have to be the boss in our lives. We need to allow the things of the Spirit to be the determining factor. Jesus is described as the shepherd and bishop of our souls. You know, the soul needs to be committed to God. The soul of men, of course, it's like your inner being as well. Yes, there's that eternal spirit, but we think of ourselves, our hearts. And Peter talked about the heart being purified in 1 Peter chapter 1 and beginning in verse 22. "Seeing you have purified your souls in obeying the truth through the Spirit unto unfeigned love of the brethren, see that you love one another with a pure heart fervently." Being born again, not of corruptible seed, but of incorruptible, by the word of God, which liveth and abideth forever. You see, for the Christian, there's been a new birth. They died to sin, and they've been born again, born anew, and raised to walk in a new life. And Peter says that in that process, our souls were purified. They were made pure. But it's our task now to keep them that way. We realize that we still will make mistakes. We still will sin. But by virtue of the blood of Christ, we can be continually cleansed. But that doesn't mean that we have a license to sin. You see, this inner man, this heart of man, is described as a hidden man in 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 4. But let it be the hidden man in the heart, or of the heart, in that which is not corruptible, even the ornament of a meek and quiet spirit, which is in the sight of God of great price. That inner person, the one that you call me, and I don't mean your body, but you're the self. He says, this is something that doesn't go to dust like the body will, but this is something that abides forever. And he says, an ornament of a meek and quiet spirit. This is what God likes. It's incorruptible. You know, God's people often suffer, and sometimes suffer for righteousness' sake. 1 Peter 4:19 again, wherefore let them that suffer according to the will of God commit the keeping of their souls unto him in well-doing as unto a faithful creator. We must make that commitment because we know that suffering does exist and that we may suffer. Let's put our trust in God. Suffering for Christ may cause one to become discouraged. And it's easy to become discouraged because we think, well, I didn't deserve that. I didn't do anything, you know, to cause somebody to do this or that to me. I didn't deserve to come into a world where there's so much trouble and there's so much sin. But nevertheless, that's the reality of the situation. The people in Peter's day were suffering from persecution. Christianity was not a lawful religion. The Roman government had to approve of your religion. They had approved of the Jewish religion. And had the Senate had granted them, you might say, license to practice their religion, and they were not to be interfered with. But Christianity had not received that. And in fact, it would be a number of centuries before Constantine would declare Christianity to be the religion of the state. That was also a mistake. You know, it seems like when the state gets into regulating religion, that problems happen. And in that time, I believe the case was that many ambitious people who sought the way to power, political power, realized that it would be through the church that they would accomplish that. And so the church was filled up with all kinds of people who really were not converted, but were using the church as a ladder, as a stepping stone to advance their careers. So we need to remember that suffering, though it is something that's unpleasant, is something also that purifies the church. Because those who are peripheral, those who are just kind of there, you know, for the benefits, they may not remain. It's those whose hearts are truly, truly convinced that Jesus Christ is the Son of God. They're the ones who remain. Peter uses the illustration of gold that's tried in the fire. You know, when you go out here, if you were a gold miner, much of the world's gold is not lying on the surface. And it's not even observable. It's locked up in ore, which is a mixture of various other elements, iron and calcium and whatever makes up the ground and the dirt and the rocks that are there. But they know there's gold in it. They've discovered that, and they take that. And the first thing they do is, of course, to process it. And part of that processing involves going into the fire, into the crucible. And there the impurities are burned off. And those that won't burn off float to the top. And what remains down at the bottom is the pure gold. And what is it that purified it? It was the fire. It was the heat. And I suggest to you that oftentimes it takes persecution. It takes affliction to purify our souls, to make us be fully committed to the Lord. Notice what Peter says in 1 Peter chapter 1, beginning at verse 6. Wherein ye greatly rejoice, though now for a season, if need be, ye are in heaviness through manifold temptations, that the trial of your faith, being much more precious than of gold that perisheth, though it be tried with fire, might be found unto praise and honor and glory at the appearing of Jesus Christ. So Peter's explaining that these afflictions that you're going through, these are like the fire that purifies the gold. That if you are gold indeed, you'll be there. You'll stay faithful. You won't quit. The soul, though, needs to be committed to God. That's like the gold. It says, you know, the gold says, I'm gold, and nothing can change that. And you need to believe in yourself that to God, you're like gold. You're precious. He paid the greatest price of all the universe to purchase you, the price of the very Son of God. Jesus gave his life to purchase you. And that means you're precious to him. And you're precious like gold is to people. But again, gold sometimes must be tried in the fire. God is the creator of our souls. In Hebrews chapter 12, verse 2, furthermore, we have had fathers of our flesh, which corrected us, and we gave them reverence. Shall we not much rather be in subjection unto the Father of spirits and live? Here, the Hebrews writer is comparing God to an earthly father. He says, earthly fathers oftentimes find it necessary to correct their children. And he's talking about discipline. And he says, God disciplines you because he's the father of spirits. He's the one who loves you like a father loves his child. And of course, his love is infinite in that we consider the great price that he paid. The word commit there, where it says commit your souls as unto a faithful creator, is the idea of a banking term. It means to deposit. When you have some money, you take it to the bank, I hope. You don't put it in your mattress. You take it to the bank and you commit it to their care. And you trust that when you want that money back, you'll get every cent. Well, likewise, we must, if we have something valuable, and we do, our eternal soul, we've got to commit it to somebody. We can commit it to the world and following the things of the world. And what's the world going to do? It's going to let it go. But we can commit it to God because God is the Father of spirits and he cares for our souls because he's the Father of spirits and he will guard that as long as we continue to remain faithful. Jesus used this word commit or command in Luke chapter 23 and verse 46 when he was being crucified. He says, when Jesus had cried with a loud voice, he said, Father, into thy hands I commend my spirit. And having said thus, he gave up the ghost. I looked that word commend up, and in the dictionary it also has the word commit. That is, I give over my soul, my spirit, to your keeping. And we must do that today. Now we realize that it remains in our bodies as long as we live. But still, we have given it over to God for him to guard and to keep. But again, he's made a way for it to be done so, and that is for us to remain faithful. You know, Paul talked about committing his soul to God in 2 Timothy chapter 1, verse 12. For the which cause I also suffer these things. Nevertheless, I'm not ashamed, for I know whom I have believed. And am persuaded that he is able to keep that which I have committed unto him against that day. Paul, you might say, had placed all of his marbles in God's care. Not one thing was left out. And that's what he wants us to do as well, is to make a full commitment to that which is most precious, our eternal soul, committed to God. Too many people commit their lives, their souls, to material things. For instance, in Luke chapter 12 and verse 21, Jesus told the parable, what we call the rich fool, the man whose crops were abundant, and he worried about not having enough space to store it all. And so he said to himself, I'll tear down my barns and build greater barns, and I'll have abundance for many years to come, and I'll sit back and eat and drink and be merry. But God says, thou fool, this night shall thy soul be required of thee. And then who shall those things be which thou hast provided? And then he went on to sum it up in verse 21 of Luke 12. So is he that layeth up treasure for himself and is not rich toward God. You see, our wealth needs to be with God. That is our spiritual wealth. Now, our physical wealth, God wants his portion of that as well. And we just gave, and hopefully we gave as we prospered. But God wants us first. The things of ourselves that we have, they're his already. He's only loaned them to us, and he'll take them back when he's ready to have them. But our spirits, we must give that of our own free will. Too many people commit their souls to pleasure. Ephesians chapter 2 and verse 3. Among whom also we all had our conversation in time past in the lusts of the flesh, fulfilling the desires of the flesh and of the mind, and were by nature children of wrath, even as others. Here Paul is talking about the fleshly lifestyle of just all the pleasure that one can experience. And many people live for that today. They see their bodies as simply a conduit for pleasure. It's a tool to be used to experience feeling good, and whatever that might involve. But that's all it's about. And when it's worn out, and when it no longer functions, just let it be gone. But that's not the way we are. We're a dual being. We have a fleshly body, but we have an eternal spirit. A spirit that God has designed to live forever. And it's his will, of course, that that body someday may be raised from the dead so that we may be suited for that better place that God has in mind for us. But if we give our lives over to pleasure, we haven't committed our souls to the keeping of our Creator. Many of the pursuits and the acquisitions of this world, they're just vain. They're empty because they don't last. This soul must be deposited to God in service unto him. That's how we do it. You know, again, in the bank with your money, you take your money and you go down to the bank and you say, here, put this on deposit for me. And they give you a receipt and you take that with you, and that tells you how much money you have in the bank. And you don't do anything more with it. It just sits there in the bank. Maybe it might accrue some interest, not much anymore, but nevertheless, it's just there. God doesn't say to us, just give me your soul and then sit back and wait. No, there's work for you to do. That's how you do it, in fact. You see, you keep your soul and your body, and it's what you do with your body now that determines whether you have committed your soul to him or whether you've committed it to something else. In 1 Peter 4:19 again, wherefore let them that suffer according to the will of God commit the keeping of their souls to him in well-doing, as unto a faithful Creator. What am I about? Well-doing. That's how I commit my soul to his keeping, is in well-doing. Not just sitting back and waiting on heaven. You know, not following after the things of pleasure in the world and think somehow God's going to fix it in the end. No, commit your souls to him in well-doing. Find those things that need done. You know, one cannot deposit his soul to God and serve sin. Jesus said in Matthew 6:24, no man can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will hold to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and mammon. Mammon is riches. You can't serve both of them. You know, again, as we noted in the reading of there at the Lord's Supper, we can't eat at the Lord's table and at the table of devils as well. We can't share them. We can't bring those two tables together. We can't go to one and the other. We're either going to be at the Lord's table serving him, or we're going to be at the devil's table serving him. Service to God is called well-doing. You know, sometimes people suffer for well-doing. Did you ever do something good for somebody and it backfired and turned out that somehow it just didn't work out good for you? You got blamed or whatever? You know, maybe an illustration would be that you got some loved one, they had a little child, and you got them a toy, but that toy turned out to be defective, or the child didn't use it properly, and he got hurt. Oh, I'm sorry I got that. You know, I feel bad now that I got that thing, because now they got hurt with it. I shouldn't have ever done that. We did it in all good conscience. You did it because of love, but sometimes things just work out that we think, well, I shouldn't have done that. Well, sometimes we might suffer because of well-doing. You might find sometimes that some good deed that you do is not received as a good deed, or that's just not appreciated, or that maybe somehow is not felt to be appropriate. Peter in 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 20, "For what glory is it? When ye be buffeted for your faults, ye shall take it patiently. But if when ye do well and suffer for it, ye take it patiently, this is acceptable with God." Peter here gives two situations. One is when you suffer for your faults. You do something wrong and you suffer for it. He says, take it patiently. You know, it's your fault. But on the other hand, there may be times when you do well and you suffer for it. He says, if you take it patiently, this is acceptable with God. Now, Jesus did well. He went about doing good. And what did they do to him? They persecuted him. And when he was arrested, they abused him. And when they were done, they crucified him. What did Jesus do to deserve that? Not one bad thing. He did good, but suffering came to him because of it. And likewise may happen to us, that we may do something good. We're trying to help in some way, and somebody may not appreciate it. Sometimes when you go to speak to somebody about the Lord, and before you even get started, they take on a belligerent and aggressive attitude and try to put you in your place, and you think, all I was trying to do was help you. All I was trying to do is to help you to go to heaven, and now I'm your enemy, and you treat me like somebody that you wouldn't treat anybody else that way simply because I wanted to speak about your soul. You see, sometimes that can happen. Men may become weary, though, in well-doing. And we need to be careful about this because we can become discouraged. Galatians chapter 6, verse 9, Paul says, "Let us not be weary in well-doing, for in due season we shall reap, if we faint not." Don't get tired of doing good. Yes, sometimes people won't appreciate it, but generally, in most cases, they will. But the important thing is that God appreciates it and that God sees it. Whatever the way it's received by men, if we're trying to do something that's right and good, God receives it in just the right way. But he says, don't become weary. Don't go tired and give up of doing good, because in due season, eventually, when the Lord comes, we shall reap. That is, we shall receive the reward. But he says, but don't faint. Don't quit. Why should men commit their souls to God? Well, man belongs to God by reason of creation. Genesis chapter 1, verse 27, "So God created man in his own image. In the image of God created he him. Male and female created he them." We should never forget that God is our owner, because he made us. If you have something at home that you made, you brought the materials together and you formed it, or you put it together with screws and glue or whatever it might be, you welded it, I don't care, that's yours by reason of creation. Well, God put us together in the beginning. He put Adam together of the dust of the ground and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life. And he brought Eve into existence from Adam's rib. And they, of course, had children. And you are their children. And God owns you just as much as he owned them. You know, Adam was a pile of dust before God breathed into his nostrils the breath of life. And we are still that same dust. And God owns us just as much. So man traces his origin to the divine creation. And so our whole duty, our whole reason for existence is to serve our Creator. Ecclesiastes chapter 12, verse 13, let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. Otherwise, our whole purpose is to respect God and to obey him. So many people have another agenda. They've got something else that they would rather do than to respect God and obey him. But the thing is, they're not committing their souls to their Creator. And in the time to come, they'll find that when they go back to that bank, which is not God's bank, it will have failed. And all of the wealth is gone. I don't think there's very many here that might remember when the banks failed back in the times of the Depression, but many people lost all their money. It just, as it were, evaporated. They had $50,000 in the bank, and the bank failed, and they said, "Your money's gone." Well, where'd it go? It's just gone. Well, how can that happen? Well, that's economics. We know God won't fail if we put our trust in Him. Think of a person who exhibited this, and the person that comes to my mind is Dorcas. Her name was Tabitha. The name means gazelle. And Acts chapter 9 tells a little bit about her life, actually about her death and resurrection. She lived at Joppa, and it says there was a certain disciple named Tabitha, which by interpretation is called Dorcas. This woman was full of good works and alms deeds, which she did. Her description is a person full of good. She was looking out for the needs of other people. But she died. But it seems that the church there just couldn't bear that. Instead of having a burial, and probably being Jewish people, that would have been that day, they washed her, put her in an upper room, and sent somebody up to Azotus, I think it was, to find Peter and to bring him back. It's amazing that they went to that trouble for whatever reason was in their mind. Did they know what Peter was going to do? I wouldn't think so. But there was just something about this woman. We've got to try. You know, and they no doubt knew about Jesus raising the dead, and they knew about some of the others that the apostles had raised. Maybe we can get this for Dorcas. But the point is that they missed her so much because of the quality of person that she was, that they sent for an apostle to do something. Well, of course, we know the story that Peter came back and raised her from the dead. In Galatians chapter 6, verse 10, it says, "As we have therefore opportunity, let us do good unto all men, especially unto them who are the household of faith." That's what Dorcas did. She did good. And there's much good that needs to be done. In fact, 1 Thessalonians 3:12 says, "And the Lord make you to increase and abound in love one toward another and toward all men, even as you do," or as we do, "toward you." Man has a soul to save in heaven or to lose for hell. You know, there's an old saying, "Dust thou art, to dust return," was never spoken of the soul. Commit your treasure to the Lord. Commit your soul to Him, because He's the only one who can keep it safe. And you do that by obeying Christ, by believing in Him, by repenting of sin, by confessing your faith, and by being buried with Him in baptism for remission of sins. And as a Christian, if you've been unfaithful, you've got your treasure in the wrong bank. Bring it back to the Lord in repentance and prayer. Our song of encouragement for you as we stand and as we sing.